we went to a park yesterday. I am notoriously angry when we go to parks. I don't like parks. There's too much fresh air, and the chairs aren't comfortable, and they rarely have televisions. And I don't really like to go most times. We went. The boys wanted to go on their new scooters to Ronald Reagan Sports Park in Temecula, which is a super cool park. If you have to go to a park, it's a really good one. This one, though, they built up this entire, I guess, all-wheel kind of sports area where they have half pipes and ramps and all sorts of stuff, and it looks like the X Games in there. And they have this great path for scooters and BMX riders and skaters that just has all these little loops and hills. And as soon as we got out of the car, I got really nervous because I knew that Jack was going to want to ride in the half pipe that was there. And there were 60 kids or more all kind of dropping into this, and it was really exciting. Some of them were really young, so I kind of felt a little bit better about it. And, of course, Jack looks at it, and he says, I want to go to there. And so we kind of – I've been nervous ever since he broke his arms – or his arm. I broke both of my arms at once. That's another story. But ever since he broke his wrist this summer, I've been really nervous, and he has not. He doesn't seem to – it doesn't bother him very much. But we got him all suited up with his pads and his helmet and everything. And we kind of head over to the drop-in spot of the path. And kind of before I could tell him too much about what he needed to do, and I was still holding his hand, he dropped in. And I was running along behind him, and actually it would have been better had he held on with both hands, but he was pulling me along, and he ended up swinging up out of the thing. And he looked at me, and he said, that was not good. And I said, no. And we tried it a few other times, and it was kind of the same thing. I would kind of start to say, well, here's what you want to do. You want to wait and then kind of make sure that you're – before I finished, he would drop back in. And it was that over and over. And finally, he said – I don't like that path, as if it was the path problem. But so we changed to the Jungle Gym, which is an amazing facility there. And one of the things that they have for some of the older kids, they have it's like a zip line sort of. You kind of hold on, and it's a track, and then that you drop down. Well, of course, Jack decided he wanted to do that, but he was a little nervous, I will say. After the fiasco at the scooter park, and so he was a little nervous to do it, and I would kind of run alongside of him the whole time. Well, the thing is, if you're an older kid, the whole idea is you zip along, and you're maybe 6 inches above the ground, above the sand, the very soft sand, and then you let go, and there's the ground. Well, for Jack, it was equal to his height, the drop. And so he would swing alongside of this, and he'd watch me the whole time next to him. And then at the end, he would sort of just look at me like, what now? And so I could have grabbed him and just kind of gently brought him down to the ground, but where's the adventure in that? So I kind of stood next to him, and I said, okay, my hands are here. Just drop, and I will catch you. And he just looked at me like, this is like the drop park one more time here. And I kept on saying, no, it's fine. I'm here to catch you. You let go and I will catch you. And I don't know if I finally wore down his fear or his fingers wore down or something, but he finally dropped. And of course I caught him before he hit the ground. And it was great fun to Jack. And he said, I didn't know that. Like he didn't put it together that I was right there. And then he did it, of course, this is Jack's favorite thing, is again. So he does it over and over. And what was really fun is I think we built up some trust in that whole exercise. Because by the end, he didn't even stop to think about it. He just let go. So it was kind of fun. It was neat to kind of build that up. And we ended the park on a high note. So I liked that. Today is Three Kings Day. It's the last day that – actually, it's tomorrow, right? Okay, tomorrow's your last time to legally keep your Christmas decorations up. After that, it's against the rules. How many people still have Christmas stuff up right now? Good for you guys. Is that just because you guys are observing or you're lazy? I don't know. But you're lazy. You're lazy, Matthew. Okay. We still have our lights out outside, but it's now it's kind of gotten, I mean, like our inflatable looks like he partied too hard on Christmas. Like he's down on the ground. Like it's ready to go. Like it's time to go.
That's me.
Yeah, that's you. All right, buddy. It's time, you know, so we're ready. We have that. But it's Three Kings Day. We celebrate, of course, the coming of how many kings? We don't know, actually, how many there were, right? We just know they bring three gifts. And what are their names? Again, we don't know. We know very little about this episode. It's very, well, that the tradition is that they are named Caspar, Melchior, and Belshazzar. But that is a very late tradition. We don't know. In fact, their role in the story disappears after this. And I think it's for a very important reason, because we're not really supposed to focus on them. In fact, the whole story is us not focusing on that. Isn't it interesting that when we get these readings leading up to it, that we hear about the psalm today, that it's like, may your king be clothed with righteousness and joy, and you know, all of the king should be awesome, Lord. Let's make the king awesome. And then the king that we hear about in this story is Herod. Like something has happened. Something has fallen apart. Real, real bad. Herod is known in history, not just in biblical history, but beyond biblical history, as a bad dude. That's an official term. Herod is somebody who, it's known that in that time, if you're a king, you got to make sure that anybody else that might usurp this thing is taken care of. Herod kind of takes that to an extreme in this story. Herod's a bad dude. And of all the places for these three wise men, these three magi, whatever you want to call them, whether there's three or not, the worst place that they could have shown up is at Herod's doorstep. When they show up, they ask the question, where is this king to be born? We saw his star. Now, what is the word that they use for that? What does everyone feel? It says Herod was deeply disturbed by this, as was everyone else in the town. And that might seem very interesting as a word, except if you think about it, the stories, the prophecy, the teaching, and the presence of God actively speaking amongst his people stopped working about four centuries before. This would absolutely be disturbing if you had experienced something like this. We haven't heard about this for 400 plus years. And the first thing that we hear are these strangers from an eastern land coming in and saying, so where do we go here? That would be disturbing. And disturbing isn't necessarily a bad thing. Disturbing complacency is maybe a good thing. That disturbance that they feel, though, is that sense of dis-ease, that sense of discomfort, of something is shifting and I have no control over it. And they're terrified. And what is their response? I have to stop it. Isn't that interesting? When you listen to this scripture today, when you hear about their response, his legitimacy as a king, Jesus, is not questioned. His royalty isn't questioned. His deity isn't even questioned. But what seems to be in question here is his authority. Herod wants to stop it. The people in Israel want to stop it. They are disturbed because they are afraid they can't stop it. And so what they do is they want to squelch out, to stop and appease this sense of fear in them, that they're going to lose control, that they will be under a different authority. Now, isn't it interesting that the prophecy that they speak of, where it talks about where this king of the Jews will be born, includes this great phrase at the end, that he will be a shepherd to his people. What does a shepherd do? Does he go where the sheep go? Does he push them on through? Or does he lead them to where they're supposed to go? And when you consider the rule of the king, a representative leader of all of the people of Israel, you have to go back to why Israel was founded in the first place. What is it that God says to Abraham? What is the promise that he makes? He says that you will be a light to the Gentiles, a light to the whole world. And in that way, these men from the East, who probably were very familiar with this promise that God made to Abraham, and very little else in Scripture, knew that if they wanted to be enlightened, to shed light on their darkness, they should go to the leader of the people. And that's what they did. They went to Herod. And Herod was supposed to be a light to these people. And what Herod offers is absolute darkness, because Herod is afraid to lose his authority. How cool is it in this story when God is promising a shepherd and the earthly leadership wants to stop any movement and leading of people to the right spot? God shepherds his people through a star. It's this really neat cosmic vision, isn't it? That if you won't do it on an earthly pattern, if you won't follow an earthly light, how about this light instead? And God, by his authority and his leadership and his shepherding, brings these people who are supposed to be living in darkness to the foot of the Son of God, born in a stable. How cool is it that God is the shepherd of their people? And when the earthly king doesn't respond right to the authority of this little one born, God uses his authority to point the light to him. See, there is no question in this scripture that Jesus is here. There is no question of his legitimacy or his royalty. There is no question even of his deity, but there is a question of what will you do with his authority? And this is what gets me every time. And I would argue it gets most people that are outside the kingdom. There is rarely a question of his legitimacy. And deep down, there's very little question of his deity. But it comes down to what you're going to be doing with this shepherd and his authority over us. I don't like giving up control. I don't like following anyone else's authority. I've got some really good ideas, and I've made a very comfortable, complacent place for myself in the muck of this world and in my sin and all the stuff that I want to do, and I'm in charge, and I don't want anyone to take that away. Whether they're the king or not, I'm in charge. Do you see, I'm not questioning that there is a shepherd. I'm questioning what I'm going to do with his authority, with his leadership. And I think we find ourselves in a place where we don't want to give that up. You know, God was very wise when he called himself the shepherd, because the implication is that we are sheep. We bite. We have our own plans. We get stuck in thickets and brambles, and we go over cliff sides because of our own desires to go in different directions. The question is not whether or not we have a shepherd. The question is, what are we going to do with his leading? You know, when we talk about normal Christian behavior, we are the Herod in that situation. We have the world coming to us looking for hope, and they might not describe it that way. We have a desire and a responsibility and a joy within us that says, here, go to this throne. But I think it begins with us following his leadership, following his authority. You know, we can't tell the world that he's our shepherd if we're just as lost as sheep. So I guess maybe this is a good New Year's message for us all. This is a good Three Kings message. Is the world is seeking out his kingship. Are we shepherded enough so that we know how to take them there? There's never a question of his deity or his royalty. There's never a question of whether or not we have a shepherd. The question is, are we letting him lead us?